Have you ever wondered what it's like to witness a murder?
Forrest grabbed the knife and then just stabbed Johnny in one motion.
Or how it feels to be shot?
I was immediately hit by a barrage of bullets.
Or how you would react if your spouse hired someone to kill you?
And he was to put me in a grave with a bullet wound on my head.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a stalking victim.
Came back upstairs, and when I came back and turned the corner into my room, I saw him standing there.
You'll hear from a man who was kidnapped and tortured.
I would do anything, say anything, to simply get away.
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Take a deep breath.
Oh my God!
Real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app, or at whatwasthatlike.com.
This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Episode 181. I can't believe it. Buiti Binafi, and thank you so much for listening. Bienvenidos, bitches. Let me tell you about Fruit Loops. It's a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that we don't hear or know much about. Contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight cis white dudes.
What?
Uh-huh. There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is a podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because the news is racist. Allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, a Black Latinx woman. And I'm Beth, and I just happen to be white.
It's not her fault, and we love her so much. Anyway, she's one of the good ones.
We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime. Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to FruitloopsPod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294. And we may feature it on a future episode.
Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com. We use Fruit Loops Pod for all our social media. The footnotes for each episode can be found on our website. Plus, check it out for the different ways that you can support the show and become a Fruit Loops patron.
Yeah.
You can also support us by supporting our sponsors and sharing our show with your friends.
Please do.
So, before we get into it, who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today we're talking about Matthew Emmanuel Macon, a.k.a. the Monster of Mid-Michigan.
Oh, dang.
A serial killer who terrorized Lansing, Michigan in the mid-2000s.
Whoa. Okay, well, before we get into that terrifying tale, how you doing?
I'm all right, you know, just getting ready for Christmas. Bought my tickets to see my daughter in North Dakota.
Sounds cold.
I'm excited to see my grandson, really.
I know. Yeah. That little cutie. Well, that's really exciting. Are you going to be there for a long time and never come back?
No.
Oh, no.
Just like 5 days because I can't take that much time off of work.
Son of a bitch.
I know.
Ugh. Well, I'm glad that you're going to get a little time off and get to spend it with the ones that you love, which is what it's all about. Am I right?
Mm-hmm.
So I had an amazing weekend.
Oh,
I went to True Crime Fest ATL.
Yeah, I'm so jealous.
Where the hip-hop air horns at? Okay. Well, I didn't know what to expect, but it was really, really cool. So I met up with Nina Instead, who's the host of Already Gone. And she's like, OG
yeah.
of true crime podcasting. Brandon with Music City 911 was my trivia partner. and I love his show so
yeah,
much.
I was such a dork
with him. He had like but he was so wonderful and kind. And Lainey, I forget her name, but she is also an OG yeah. of true crime podcasting. Cam and Jen from Our True Crime Podcast, wonderful. Murder She Told was there. Crime Lines was there. Whitney and Melissa from Colts Crimes and Cab were there. And Eric from True Crime Consequences, the host of Southern Gothic, Brandon, was there. Bob with the Fence Diaries was there. That was pretty cool. I'm sorry if I'm forgetting anyone, but thank you so much, Nina. I think Nina was the one who put it all on. And thanks to everyone who came out. It was great. It was wonderful. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Do they do that every year?
They're planning on doing it all over the country, is understanding.
Okay.
So they'll have different ones in different cities at different venues. And whichever true crime podcaster is local to that area will be responsible for like picking the place.
So there's
and all
a
that
lot
stuff.
Of local podcasts in Atlanta.
No.
Oh, okay.
So Nina is from lives in two places, but one of her residences is in Atlanta. But everybody else like flew in from Texas or wherever. So it was just really, really, really cool. Yeah. So
right on. Well, I'm glad you had fun and you got to meet all the folks. And
I missed you.
I'm jealous. I wish I'd been able to go.
I know. Me too. And I think that if you had been my trivia partner, no offense, Brandon, we would have won. But me and Brandon were like, I don't know this. Who killed who in the 70s? I don't know. My answer for all the questions was like doo-doo head. but it didn't get very many laughs. Anyway, so let's get into some listener letters.
Hello, angels. Thank you.
What's in that bag, Beth?
All right. I just wanted to say thanks to Isaac for your kind letter.
Okay. So we have two Patreons. Shout out to Gigi and shout out to Melissa L.
Okay.
So happy holidays. Rocking around with Gigi at the True Crime Podcast. hope you like that, Gigi. All right.
Thank you, Gigi.
And then Melissa. Feliz Melissa. Feliz Melissa. Feliz Melissa. Y muchas gracias por tu Patreon. So thank y'all so much for supporting our little show. We're going to take a quick break and then we're going to get into the story when we come back.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
All right, so let's talk about batteries, specifically social batteries.
Okay.
Now, during the winter, you know, like my battery was like really drained and I really just couldn't wait for it to be over. And now that winter is gone, I am feeling more energized socially. So
nice.
I can manage having friends over at my house and going out to do things. But I have to do a lot of mental preparing.
Yeah.
And then I also have to have time to recover from the people and the things.
Oh, yeah. I get that. And I know there are people out there who are energized and even thrive on being around people.
Yeah.
But I am definitely not one of those people.
No, ma'am. No, ma'am. The thing is, you know, sometimes our batteries can get drained when we say yes to all the things and to all the people. And we forget to, you know, set boundaries and set aside time and space for ourselves.
Everyone's different.
Right.
And the good news is that therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery.
Well, that sounds great.
Yeah.
I definitely had many sessions with my therapist about boundaries and positive coping skills. And therapy is, dare I say, empowering.
Yeah.
And it can help you become the
bestest version of yourself and can help you determine when your battery is beyond depleted or needs a refresher.
Yeah. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule.
Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge.
Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/fruit today to get 10% off your first month.
That's BetterHelp.com/fruit.
Hi, I'm Matt Harris. Seton Tucker and I host the podcast Impact of Influence, which for 2 years covered in depth Alec Murdoch, who was eventually convicted in 2023 of murdering his wife Maggie and son Paul. That story continues to evolve, and we will cover that. Plus, we will tell you stories of other true crime events that have happened in the South. Please join us on Impact of Influence and give us a follow on the Impact of Influence Facebook page.
All right. Well, hey, we're back. Remind us, Beth, who is our subject?
Today we're talking about Matthew Emmanuel Macon, a serial killer who terrorized Lansing, Michigan.
Oh, Santa Maria, let's get into some stay a yet! Oh my God. Is 2022 over yet? Because I'm sick of this shit.
We're getting close.
Good. Okay. So first I want to say rest in power to all the victims who lost their lives. Peace and love to the survivors, because there are people who survived his attacks. And also peace and love to the individuals and community left in the wake of these horrific acts.
Yeah.
So these are the people who were assaulted and murdered. Barbara Jean Tuttle, 45. We don't know her race. Carolyn Cronenberg, 60 years old, was white. Ruth Hallman, 76 years old, was white. Deborah K. Cook, 36, race not reported. Deborah Renfors, 46, was white. Sandra Eichhorn, 64, race not reported. Karen Louise Delgado Yates, 41, was Latinx. And Linda Jackson was 56. Her race was not reported. She was assaulted and beaten. Linda survived and was key in getting justice for the others who did not.
She's a survivor. She's not going to give up.
You know what I think of is that, you remember when Whitney Houston, she was like, she got an award and she was like, I'm a survivor. What? What? I want to thank my team. Linda, Mary, Macon, Wendy, Beth. You remember that?
I don't.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, guess it's just me and TikTok. Anyway, Macon's nickname was, I think, Chicky or Chili?
Huh. I didn't read about that. No.
He went by like Chicky Smith. You gave a fire. I don't know if I should say fire, but the monster of mid-Michigan. I didn't see that one in my research. His crimes escalated to murder in 2004 and 2005. There were numerous other assaults and beatings in Lansing, not officially linked to Macon, but very likely done by him. His victims were various races and ethnicities. Some were sex workers and some were not. But what all these women had in common is that they were alone or lived alone. His MO was violent assault and beating and murder is called murder. I just made it up. So he would beat his victims to murder them. And so there is a sexual assault component in his crimes as well. So now it's time to get into the setting. Take us there, Beth.
Well, the setting is Lansing, a city in central Michigan. The Anishinaabeg people, who originally inhabited the area, are a group of culturally related indigenous peoples present in the Great Lakes region of Canada and the United States. They include the Ojibwe, Odawa, Potawatomi, Mississaugas, Nipissing, and Algonquin peoples.
The Anishinaabeg ceded the land to the United States in the 1819 Treaty of Saginaw. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've gone to look for America, where there were already people there. But so the indigenous people did not cede their rights to live on and use the land. Nevertheless, the United States government then designed and deployed legal means, and only legal according to the colonizers' laws and their laws
right,
alone.
Right, exactly.
To remove indigenous peoples in violent ways and reallocate lands to European and European American settlers.
Surprise!
Look at that.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
The area that is now Lansing was originally surveyed in 1825 in what was then dense forest. In the winter of 1835 and early 1836, two brothers from New York plotted the area that is now known as REO Town, a neighborhood just south of downtown Lansing, and they named it Biddle City. What a name.
Oh, like Tiggle Bitties, huh? Also, you rarely do voices, and I'm so surprised, overjoyed. I don't know.
Yeah, I did that for you.
Thank you so much, friend. Well, I'm all set for Christmas. All of this land lay in a floodplain and was underwater during the majority of the year. Regardless, the brothers went back to New York, specifically Lansing, New York, to sell plots for the town that did not exist. Mm. They told the residents of Lansing, New York, that this new city had an area of 65 blocks, contained a church, and also a public and academic square.
Hmm, sounds nice.
Oh my goodness, how do I sign up? Oh wait, I'm black, I can't. A group of 16 men bought plots in the non-existent city.
Upon reaching the area later that year, they found that they had been scammed.
Oh my God. Wow.
Bummer.
They had Airbnb scams before Airbnb.
Before Airbnb.
Look at this.
Yeah. Those who stayed quickly renamed the area Lansing Township in honor of their home village in New York. The settlement of fewer than 20 people remained a sleepy village until the winter of 1847.
At the time, Detroit was the capital of Michigan, but many people were concerned about Detroit's close proximity to British-controlled Canada, which had captured Detroit in the War of 1812. During a multi-day session to determine a new location for the state capital, many cities, including Ann Arbor, Marshall, and Jackson, lobbied hard to win the designation.
Unable to reach a consensus due to the constant political wrangling, out of frustration, the Michigan House of Representatives chose the township of Lansing. When announced, many present openly laughed that such an insignificant settlement was now the capital city of Michigan.
Wow. So 2 months later, Lansing Township was officially made the state capital. The legislature shortened the township's name to Lansing. In 1859, the settlement having grown to nearly 3,000 people and encompassing about 7 square miles was incorporated as a city. Wow, you guys are really doing
seven
big things.
7 square miles.
Okay, Lansing.
In August 1897, Olds Motor Vehicle Company was founded in Lansing. In 1905, the founder, Ransom E. Olds, started his REO Motor Car Company, which would last in Lansing for another 70 years. REO Town, the neighborhood we mentioned earlier, is named after Olds and the REO brand. And just as an aside, the REO Speedwagon was a light motor truck model, an ancestor of the modern pickup truck manufactured by REO Motor Car Company. Yeah.
I thought it was just a band that stood up for their names. Wow. Oh my God. My mind is so blown right now. Clark and Company Carriage Works also produced the less successful Clark Mobile in Lansing in 1903. The city was transformed into a major American industrial center for the manufacturing of cars and car parts, among other industries. The city continued to grow, and by 1956, it was 15 square miles.
Wow.
Oh my God, double it! It then doubled in size over the next decade to its current size of roughly 33 square miles. Wow.
Wow.
When you dream big.
Under Michigan's civil rights statute, racial discrimination in public places was unlawful. The statute was, of course, not enforced until African-American dentist Emmett Bolden in 1925 asked for seating on the main floor of Keith's Theater. The theater's refusal led to a landmark 1927 decision of the Michigan Supreme Court, which overturned a lower court decision in favor of the theater.
Wow. But in other later cases, the court's position was that theaters, circuses, racetracks, private parks, and the like were private enterprises, and anything not government sponsored or funded could discriminate as they pleased.
Woo-hoo.
Who wants to do all that? You know how much work it is to discriminate? Why?
Oh,
stop it. The Michigan Michigan Supreme Court also held that racial covenants, deed provisions forbidding homeowners to resell to Black people, and other practices hampering housing integration and also wealth in Black communities were not illegal under Michigan or federal civil rights laws.
Malcolm X lived in the Lansing vicinity from 1928 to 1940. At first, the family lived in the white neighborhood of Westmont. Malcolm's father, Earl Little, disturbed the status quo by refusing to move to the Black area of town, and he gained a reputation as being a quote-unquote uppity Negro, unquote.
Holy shit. Well, welcome to Culture Corner with Wendy and Beth. An uppity Negro? What's that? Well, it is a fearless Black person who, by social definition, is not in their place, or who goes against the rules of white supremacist society and norms. If a white person or someone from a higher caste interpreted a Black or Indigenous person's actions as uppity, it was often fatal. You could die.
Yeah.
Ends up happening to Malcolm X's father. He was killed by the Klan.
The land company that owned the Westmont subdivision took Earl Little to court in 1929. The company argued that because the land contract stated only Caucasians could live there, Earl was in breach of contract. The court ruled that Earl Little could own property in the subdivision, but he could not live there.
What?
Therefore, he and his family had to vacate the home. Yeah.
Oh, my God. But before the eviction took place, the Little's house was burned down and the police arrested Earl on arson charges. Are you kidding me? Which were later dropped. The family has always maintained that the Black Legion, a white supremacist group with connections to the KKK, was responsible for the arson.
On September 28, 1931, a streetcar hit Earl Little, killing him. The authorities ruled it a suicide, but Malcolm and his family believed that the Black Legion was responsible.
Oh, my God.
Because Earl Little's death certificate declared suicide, his wife Louise could not collect insurance money, and the family fell into financial hardship. That is really shitty.
It is really shitty. And then Malcolm X ended up, you know, turning to a life of crime to support himself, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And we know what happened after that. So in 1990, Lansing was the 145th largest city in the United States, with a population of approximately 127,000. It's since fallen to the 268th largest city in the United States. Lansing is currently 11.2% smaller than it was in 1990.
Many of Michigan's cities share an economic history dominated by manufacturing, characterized by slow or declines in economic growth from 1990 to 2000. In 1970, the average share of residents in the older industrial cities employed in manufacturing was almost 31%, with all having a manufacturing employment share of at least 25%. So, you know, these big manufacturing cities, a lot of people worked in
the industry. I think of like The Simpsons. You could go get a job in the Motor City, raise a family, three kids, wife stay at home. It was a good place to work or a good industry
while
to be
lasted.
In at the time. Yeah. But deindustrialization over the past several decades has left these cities struggling. It's been a very tough transition for Michigan as a whole and for the Lansing region in particular. From 1970 to 2000, the average number of these cities' residents who were employed in manufacturing declined by over 46%.
Wow.
Yeah. 23% of residents have an income below the poverty line.
The racial demographics of Lansing at the time when our subject was growing up there were 73% white and 19% Black. Less than 1% were Native American. Lansing has since become less white and more Black. As of the 2020 census, it is 51% white and 23% Black.
Oh, that's interesting. So now we're going to get into Matthew Macon's early life. So Matthew Emmanuel Macon, a Black male, was born on September 8th, 1979 in Lansing. He grew up with physical and sexual abuse by his father, who did the same to Matthew's older sister. Not a great formative experience for a young child.
No. Not at all. Mm-mm. That middle name, though, Emmanuel.
Emmanuel.
Yeah. So Emmanuel means God is with us. Very nice to give your child that name, but it's not so good when your kid turns out to be a serial killer.
Yeah, really. Yeah, you're right. Let's see. Who knows? Maybe Matthew might have ended up being very different if he had had a better childhood.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
His was just awful. Next level awful. a scale of 1 to 10, it was like a 20.
So one of Minnie's favorite versions of the Christmas carol, O Come, O Come, Emmanuel, is the Joan Baez version. Have you heard it?
Who?
Joan Baez.
I don't think I know who that is.
White lady in the 60s. She was like a my favorite. Folk just singer. Kidding. Yeah.
Nope. Not familiar.
Anyway, Minnie says, quote, "The song didn't exactly conjure up thoughts of brutal serial killer for me before, but it does now."
Whoa.
Thanks, Matthew Emmanuel Macon. And by that, I mean, fuck you very much. Miserable excuse for a Macon.
There we go.
I bet all the real Macons don't want to claim you as their own. Fake Macon, just like fake bacon. No one wants it. Okay, I'm done.
Wow. Unquote. Okay.
That's Minnie.
Yeah, that's Minnie.
Another one.
Whoa. So, who knows? Maybe Matthew might have ended up being very different had he had a better childhood, but his was just awful. There was just nothing good to say about the childhood he was given.
Yeah. Reportedly, Matthew's father would also use broomsticks and other objects to commit sexual and physical abuse against his children and his wife on a regular basis.
Oh.
Not only was Matthew subjected to this abuse himself, he was also forced to witness the abuse of his mother and sister.
Oh my God. So Matthew's older sister was eventually placed into foster care when the abuse of her came to light in 1983, when Matthew was only 4 years old. After this, Matthew himself became a ward of the state as well.
He spent the remainder of his youth in different group homes and juvenile facilities, lacking any kind of stability in his life, with the memories of horrible abuse witnessed and felt at such a young age as the only constant to carry with him.
In 1989, when Matthew was 10 years old, he ran away from a foster care home. He was subsequently branded a delinquent court ward. That same year, he was charged with and pleaded guilty to breaking into a Lansing bike shop and comic store. 10-year-old stuff. He was just 10 years old. 10.
Right.
He didn't really have any chance of anything like a normal childhood.
Yeah. 3 years later, in 1992, he was sent to a place called Boys Town in Nebraska.
Oh.
And that sounds like one of those places that seems nice, but is actually terrible.
Uh-huh.
So a little history on Boys Town. Originally called Father Flanagan's Boys Home, it was founded by Irish immigrant Father Edward Flanagan in 1917 as an orphanage for boys, regardless of their race or religion.
A fierce critic of the eugenics movement, when Father Flanagan wanted to expand his home for boys, and he was informed by Omaha authorities that Jim Crow laws made it illegal. He was mixing them races, religions, and nationalities. Said, fuck you guys. He just built his own village. And Boys Town is now an official village in Nebraska. I've seen it with my own eyes.
Yeah.
And I was worried. Yeah.
Saying, quote, "There are no bad boys. There is only bad environment, bad training, bad example, bad thinking," unquote. Father Flanagan was charismatic and beloved by many. Spencer Tracy played him in the movie Boys Town in 1938 and won an Oscar for his performance. I haven't seen it, but there's that.
Okay.
And Charles Nicholas Deacon Jones, a Black American steeplechase runner who competed at the 1956 and 1960 Olympics, was an alumni of Boys Town.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I went into kind of a rabbit hole about Father Flanagan. I was looking for anything bad about him, and it seems like he was legit. He was a good person. And he genuinely wanted to help these kids because he saw how they were being treated other places.
Mm.
And he wanted them to have a good environment. And
Yeah.
A lot of the boys thought of him actually as their dad. And he was on, when they joined the army, they would list him as their father. And Yeah. So it seems like he was legit.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That warms my heart.
I know. Me too.
Well, in 1948, President Harry Truman sent Father Flanagan to Germany to help address the crisis of displaced children following the Second World War. He had a massive heart attack in Berlin and died there on May 17th, 1948. Oh no.
Yeah. Father Flanagan once said, quote, "The work will continue, you see, whether I'm there or not, because it's God's work, not mine," unquote. But since his death, Boys Town has been surrounded by controversy, including various allegations of fraud, abuse, and sexual abuse.
That is unfortunate. In 1993, when Matthew was 14, he was arrested for sexually assaulting a girl with a stick. And the girl's reported to be younger than 13 years old.
Wow.
He pleaded guilty to the charges and was placed in a juvenile facility.
While in the facility, Matthew, along with a friend from the facility, decided to escape. Using their not yet fully developed juvenile brains, they also made the great decision to steal a car and break into a grocery store. Of course, they got caught, and Matthew was then sent to yet another juvenile facility, one that provided sex offender treatment.
When Matthew was 16, at a juvenile court hearing in Ingham County, a court referee said of him that he would require lifetime vigilance, even though he was making progress in the program. The referee noted that sexual offending is like an addiction for Matthew. After he completed a sexual offender program in October 1997, when he was 18, a social worker said at his hearing that the likelihood that he would commit another sex offense was, quote, "very slim," unquote. Well, I guess we can end the episode.
Yeah. Everybody lived happily ever after.
All right. I'm just kidding.
From DNA testing to the Dixie Mafia, Crime Capsule brings you new stories of true crime in American history. I'm your host, Benjamin Morris. Join us for exclusive interviews with authors from Arcadia Publishing, writing the hottest books on the most chilling stories of our country's past. You can find us wherever you get your favorite podcasts or on evergreenpodcasts.com. Crime Capsule, history so interesting, it's criminal.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
Now let's hop on into the timeline. Hop, hop.
After Macon was released as an adult, he ended up being picked up again for larceny in 1999 when he was 20. He pleaded guilty, was given credit for time served while awaiting trial, and ended up with 3 years probation, which he then violated in 2001. That didn't take long.
Wow, of course he did. So he was then sentenced to 10 years in prison for the violation.
Wow.
Then released on parole again in 2003.
Whoa, so he got 10 years? But he was released like almost immediately.
Which I don't understand. Okay. Big shocker here. Get ready. He violated his parole once more and was sent back. Then he was paroled again in 2004. How many lives does this guy have?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. On December 20th, 2004, 45-year-old Barbara Jean Tuttle was found bludgeoned to death in her home on North Washington in Lansing, where she lived alone. The week prior, she had been sexually assaulted, but unable to positively identify her attacker.
Oh, my God.
Man.
Wow.
I wonder if it
was the same
guy. Attacker.
Yeah, it was Macon. All signs point to yes.
Yes, yeah. We couldn't find much information about Barbara, but she had been described by people who knew her as a very sweet person. Hmm. Police were unable to find enough evidence to identify a suspect at the time, and the case went cold.
On the morning of Tuesday, January 25th, 2005, 60-year-old college professor Carolyn Cronenberg, a white woman, was preparing to teach a class when she was attacked. She was found murdered inside her classroom at Lansing Community College in Lansing, Michigan. She had been sexually assaulted with a computer remote control device, badly beaten and left to die.
Carolyn was an honored member of faculty, having been awarded a Distinguished Service Award in 1991. Mm. She'd been teaching at the college for a long time, and other faculty and students knew and liked her. She specialized in teaching student development courses, such as techniques of study, successful interpersonal relationships, and dealing with stress. This was a terrible loss to the college community, as a lot of the students who start at community college really need to learn those skills in order to do well in their classes and in life in general.
Rest in power, Carolyn. 2 days later, on January 25th, 2005, 26-year-old Claude McCollum, he was a neurodivergent Black student. He was struggling with homelessness, and he often slept at the college where Carolyn taught. He was a student there. He was taking business classes, I think. But he was arrested and brought in for questioning at the Lansing police station.
The investigators told him he might be able to help them solve a murder.
Oh my God.
Wanted to help. So he agreed to cooperate and submitted to a lengthy interview with them. During the interview, they asked Claude how, if he were the murderer, he might have killed Carolyn.
Oh my God.
Based on his responses, they then charged him with rape and murder because, according to them, he gave details only the killer would have known.
Mm.
More likely, they fed him those details. Making a murderer anyone?
Hello. Hello.
Yeah, this sounds so familiar.
Yeah. And this is January 2005. And this wasn't taped. It wasn't a taped questioning, which is also fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
So more than a year later, in February 2006, Claude McCollum's trial in Ingham County Circuit Court finally began. Evidence was given that a strand of fiber was found on McCollum's clothing and that the fiber might have come from Cronenberg's sweater. I'm going to say that again. Might have come from it. Is that barely that's all you need to close a case these days in 2006 in Lansing, Michigan.
Yeah.
Shame on them.
And get this. There was also testimony that the DNA found under Carolyn's fingernails did not match Claude, but was from an unidentified male.
Okay.
So it did not match Claude, and it did match an unidentified male. An unidentified male who was not Claude. but that confession, though, right? Totally solid. So solid, in fact, that the jurors were convinced by it, and Claude was found guilty.
I'm baffled by people who believe confessions.
Yeah.
It just, in the face of all the evidence, and we'll get into, this was I hate what they did to Claude, but it also allowed for the real bad guy to continue to do what he was doing and justice to not really be served for the victims up to this point.
Yeah.
So on February 14th, 2006, the jury convicted Claude McCollum of the 2005 sexual assault and murder of Carolyn Cronenberg, and he was sentenced to life in prison on fucking Valentine's Day. Damn.
Wow. The community believed they were now safe because the brutal killer had been removed from the streets. The attacks had stopped because, coincidentally, right around the time that Claude was incarcerated and undergoing trial, Macon, let's just call him Bago Bits.
Okay.
had been imprisoned yet again for parole violations. Oh, and for the third degree home invasion and assaulting, resisting, obstructing a police officer. Bako Bits was released again on parole on June 26, 2007.
Wow. So on July 26, 2007, a month later, neighbors arrived at the home of 76-year-old Ruth Hallman, a white woman who lived on West Leeper Street in Lansing, to find her severely injured, but still conscious and moving. Ruth had been able to crawl to her front door, 76 years old and beaten, to let them in, but had not been able to open it. The neighbors thought she had injured herself on her lawnmower, then fell and cut her head, but paramedics called to the scene discovered it was much worse than that.
She had been so brutally attacked that one of her fingers was almost completely severed.
Whoa.
And she had been hit so hard with a hammer on the side of her head that there was a hole in her skull.
Oh my gosh.
She was still somewhat conscious in transport to the hospital and told the paramedics to call the police, but she couldn't elaborate and soon became unable to answer any more questions. 2 days later, she succumbed to her injuries.
Oh, my goodness. Rest in power, Ruth. Ruth was described as a giving person who would do anything for other people, never asking for anything in return. She was well-loved in the community, having always reached out to help those in need, taking them to the doctor, to the market, or giving them food, clothing, or money if they needed it. She would spend time going to yard sales to buy things to give to others in the neighborhood. Over 400 people came to a celebration of life service for Ruth. Wow.
Ruth had also wanted her neighborhood to be safe for kids to play in and had been active with the police department, giving them information about potential drug houses, drug dealers, supplying lists of names, landlords, and even license plate numbers.
Wow. She sounds like she is not to be messed with, right?
No.
That's a good, yeah. That's the kind of auntie or grandma you want in your neighborhood. Nobody will get away with anything. So hours after Ruth was found, detectives interviewed a confidential informant who told them that the local drug dealers were likely responsible for her attack. Can't always trust what those informants are,
nope.
are feeding you. The informant was alleged to have said that, quote, old white lady had seen something she should not have seen. So they had made an example out of her, unquote. Okay.
The informant gave names and agreed to set up the drug dealers to get them arrested. So early the next morning, officers from the city's special tactics and rescue team raided the alleged dealer's apartment, arresting four men on drug charges. Detectives interviewed them, but they denied any involvement in Ruth's assault. Other arrests of alleged drug dealers led to similar dead ends.
At the time, even though there were similarities between Ruth's death and the 2004-2005 deaths of Barbara Jean Tuttle and Carolyn Cronenberg, police hadn't yet linked them. As Carolyn's murder was considered solved, and because remember Claude, what they did to Claude, and Ruth's murder right. was considered a drug dealer revenge killing. Barbara's murder was still unsolved, but was considered a separate incident.
About 2 weeks after Ruth's attack and days after her funeral, at about 4:30 a.m. on August 7th, 2007, police on a routine patrol found the body of 36-year-old Deborah K. Cook in Hunter Park on the city's east side. Like the other women, she'd been brutally beaten about the face and head. Her body had been left naked below the waist, and a stick had been inserted into her vagina.
Deborah's body had been found leaning against a tree about 50 yards from Hunter Park's public pool, which was empty and undergoing renovations that summer. Joe Nelson, executive director of the nearby Allen Neighborhood Center, said in an interview with the Lansing State Journal at the time that Hunter Park was a different place at night, a haven for sex work and drug deals. She noted the neighborhood was working to change the atmosphere in the park, having recently added a hoop house to grow vegetables and paved a walking path. Wow, progress.
A hoop house? The fuck is a hoop house? Sounds fun. Hoop, there it is. Hoop, there it is. So I looked it up, and I guess a hoop house is a small greenhouse. Yeah, that'll fix all the problems. Sounds like a great place to start growing some cannabis. So this is from Minnie. She says, I mean, I guess it is kind of a nice thing to do that, to try to change the atmosphere of the park, make it a place where more people might want to go. But I'm not sure a greenhouse with a walkway left alone at night is really any better than a park without those things left alone at night. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a privileged, basic white lady solution to a problem that is way too complex to be solved by the simple addition of a greenhouse or maybe a pumpkin spice latte cart, if I'm being honest here. I feel like the money spent on that could have been better spent elsewhere. Like, I don't know, social services, maybe free mental health care, job opportunities, affordable housing, possibly, maybe
anyone out
anyone?
There?
Anyone
listening?
Bueller.
So there were notable similarities between Deborah's murder and the other murders in Lansing. She was single, she was beaten, and she had been sexually assaulted with a foreign object. But Deborah was younger than the other victims, and police knew her as a sex worker. So they missed the connection. Again, or they just ignored it because she was a sex worker. And great job, you messy ass hoes. Just outstanding work, nigga.
On August 3rd, 2007, Bakobits stopped attending a Lansing's a Lansing substance abuse treatment program that he'd been mandated to attend as part of his parole. But for some reason, the treatment program officials didn't find it necessary to notify Bako Bitz's parole officer about it.
Okay. So on August 9th, 2007, a woman in Lansing called 911 to report that her ex-boyfriend, Matthew E. Macon, had kicked in a window at her house and threatened to kill her. Mm. She had fled, taking her cell phone with her. Lansing police at the time didn't think the incident important enough to inform Bako Bitz's parole officer about it, and didn't see a connection to any other recent events, so failed to pick Bako Bitz up for questioning. And I'm just curious, this woman is reporting that somebody tried to kill her. We don't know for sure, but I'm under the impression his ex-girlfriend was a Black woman or a woman of color. And that might have contributed to them ignoring her pleas for help.
Yeah, but also they, you know, a lot of times they do, especially, you know, back, what, 15 years or so ago, they just ignore women.
Blame it on her.
They don't help disregard it. Yeah.
So you might say they epically failed.
Yeah. So that same day, on August 9th, 2007, Lansing police had discovered the body of 46-year-old Deborah Renfors, a white woman, in her home on North Washington Street. She'd been sexually assaulted and beaten to death.
Deborah had moved to Lansing 7 years prior from Mount Clemens, Michigan, a city on the outskirts of Detroit. Friends say that she was a sex worker who was trying to get out of the business and had lately been cleaning homes for work to try to find another way to support herself.
Deborah was the third woman to be bludgeoned to death in the city in 2 weeks, and she was found in the same house on Washington Avenue where Barbara Jean Tuttle had been found back in December of 2004. The same house.
Wow.
It's like he either wanted to get caught or wanted to test whether or not he could kill someone in the very same house years later and get away with it.
Yeah.
Or maybe he felt connected to this house in some way. I don't know. Maybe he just got a kick out of it. I don't know.
I kind of think he did. And there's another part of the story where I'm like, oh, he's playing with them. He thinks this is a game. So in any event, Lansing police finally figured out that they were dealing with a serial killer. The victims were mostly older women living alone, were usually sexually assaulted, and were bludgeoned to death with whatever object was nearby and handy. Handy? Is that the right word for this? Oh, this hammer is so handy for killing folks. Come on down to Harbor Freight, or you can order it on Amazon. It's so handy. Sounds very weird. Anyway, long story short, it was a similar MO for all of the murder.
Now that detectives knew they had a serial killer to catch, they put together a task force and began to do research on older cases in Lansing and uncovered a string of unsolved sexual assaults of older women on the city's west side in 2003. These women had also been beaten and sexually assaulted and reported that their attacker had initially come to their door offering to do yard work, then got into their homes by asking for a glass of water or to use the phone.
No. On August 27, 2007, 64-year-old retiree Sandra Eichorn was found stabbed to death in her home where she lived alone. She was retired from a General Motors plant and was a fan of NASCAR racing and of playing Keno. So she lived just around the corner from Harry's Place, a popular bar on the city's west side, where she would regularly go to play Keno.
Sandra had been at home eating a bowl of spaghetti when she was interrupted by the killer. In the bowl, police found a business card to a computer repair store on Saginaw Street. Okay, now I'm thinking you really did want to get caught.
Yeah.
That's a really obvious clue to be left in a bowl of food where no one would just accidentally leave something like that.
Right.
Quite literally, a calling card was left to be found by police, like saying, here I am, come and get me.
Yeah, it's, I know we've talked about serial killers in the past who like collect things from their victims, but he seems to like staging.
Leave things.
Yeah. So anywho, fortunately, the Lansing police didn't miss the significance of this either. Wow. Way to go, guys.
Wow. That's shocking.
Well done. And went to the computer repair store Go-Go Inspector Gadget Repair Store to see if they could get more information about the killer. When the police talked to the store's owner, he told them that a black man had come into the shop asking to have a password changed on a laptop. The man said that a friend had given him the laptop.
Okay. When the store owner asked the man for his name, number, and address, all typical information that you would normally give at a store to have work like this done, the man didn't want to give it. Immediately, this made the owner think that the laptop was likely stolen, and he persisted in asking the man for this information. Eventually, the man gave his phone number, address, and his name, which turned out to be Matthew Macon. Bake a bits!
Got him! So, on August 28th, 2007, Linda Jackson answered a knock at her back door. Back door? Red flag from someone
that would scare
who,
me.
Yeah. But I wonder if, I don't know much about the Midwest. It's a foreign land, but if it's one of those neighborhoods where people don't have back fences.
There are, I have lived in places like that where there's no fences. Yeah. It's always really weird.
Yeah.
To me.
Give
me a big fence.
Exposed. Lock me in my own prison, please.
Yeah.
So he claimed to be looking for work. She explained that she didn't have any money in the house and that her dog didn't like strangers, so she couldn't let him in or give him any work at the moment. She asked him to give her his name and contact info so that she could contact him at a later date if she had some work for him and money to pay him for the work. That's a very smart thing to do.
It is, yeah. Mm-hmm. He gave his name, Matthew Macon, and when she turned to get a pad of paper to write it down, he walked into her house and began beating her about the head with a beer bottle.
Oh my God.
She screamed, and as she did so, her dog came rushing downstairs, barking, and scared Bako Bits away.
Yes! Oh, I love it.
The dog ran him off before he could do anything else to Linda, and now she had his name, which she did not hesitate to give to the police when they came to talk to her at the hospital.
Yes. Wonderful job, Linda. So with Linda's description of her attacker and the name she supplied, plus evidence in her house, police were able to get an arrest warrant to pick up Bako Bits, a.k.a. Macon, up. Linda, you are our hero. I need a hero. La, 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 in the night. And her name is Linda. She gave the description of her attacker.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I could no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get 6,000 cash, give us each 3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com. Or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Now, we are going to get into the investigation and the arrest. Hit it, Beth!
That night, officers spotted a pedestrian who fit the description of Bako Bits. All the law enforcement agencies involved in the search converged on the area where he'd been seen. Police officers jumped out of their cars and apprehended him. The arresting officers told Bako Bits that he was being arrested on a parole violation warrant, but he knew something else was up by the number of police vehicles that had converged on the area, commenting, quote, "All this for a warrant?" unquote. Yeah, so he's not dumb,
right,
this guy.
Right. And he's also very familiar with the law enforcement and what they do. So this might have been unusual compared to all the other times he'd been picked up. Right. So Stuart Dunnings, the Ingham County prosecutor at the time, said that it was unusual for a multiple homicide serial killer case to be solved this quickly. Without Linda, it might have taken much longer to catch him. I mean, considering the track record of the messy Hoenn Lansing Police Department so far, much longer. And more middle-aged women living alone would have been assaulted and killed. But hey, those middle-aged ladies' lives are over anyway, right?
Right.
Yeah, so who cares if somebody attacks these older ladies living alone, especially the ones who've been involved in sex work? They don't matter, right? And this is, you know, obviously not true to us, but this is the attitude and actions of law enforcement. So they just threw these people away and they need to do better.
Yes. While Baco Bits big.
It is a good
name. It is a good name.
Well done, Minnie.
While Baco Bits was already in custody on August 29th, 2007, the day after the attack on Linda, 41-year-old Karen Louise Delgado Yates, a Latinx woman, was found inside a vacant house on Hickory Street in Lansing, severely injured but still alive. The house had been up for sale, and a prospective buyer who happened to be looking through the house that day found her.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Can you imagine? You're looking for a house to buy and you find a body.
Well, yeah. I'm a sicko. I can imagine.
It's a dream.
It is a weird fantasy that I have.
It's a nightmare for me, but a dream for you.
And I mean, what became of this house? Did anybody ever buy it? And who cleans it up?
Who cleans that up?
I have so many questions.
Yeah. So Karen was rushed to the hospital, but she died on the way.
Oh, gosh. Rest in power, Karen. An autopsy performed on her showed that she had a fractured skull, brain hemorrhage, a broken nose, several cracked ribs, and cuts and bruises. In addition to having been beaten by her attacker, she had been sexually assaulted. And there was evidence that she had been tortured. Karen was known to the police as a sex worker. The MO and Karen's traits fit with the other attacks, so her assault and murder were linked to Baco Bits as well.
It was on this date after Baco Bits had been arrested that Baco Bits's parole officer was finally given the information that he had stopped going to his court-ordered substance abuse treatment program back on August 3rd and had attempted to break in and assault his ex-girlfriend and threatened to kill her back on August 9th, 20 days prior to the discovery of Karen's body in the vacant house. Excellent timing on passing on that info, guys. Mm-hmm, just stellar work there.
Yep.
You can't see it, but my eyes just rolled so hard that I can see my own brain right now.
Whoa, that's incredible side eye. Look at that there. 10 out of 10. So detectives held three separate interview sessions with Baco Bits, during which he finally confessed to 7 killings in all, dating back to 2004. He coldly listed off the killings like he was compiling some sort of grocery list. Okay, let's see. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. There's 6 people, you know, that I have murdered, and I murdered them all, unquote. And he's a British. He's
a masterpiece in this story.
He's become
British. Yeah.
Sorry, whoops.
During one interview, Baco Bits said that he had beaten Ruth Hallman to death with a small hammer that he found in her home. He had been easily able to get her to let him in her home because of her tendency to want to help everyone. Ugh, that's so awful.
Yeah.
He had asked her for something, and as she turned to go into the house for it, he'd followed her in.
That is really scary.
Devious.
Quote, I pulled a little drawer out and then I seen the hammer and she had her head down and I hit her in the head. Boom. And when I hit her in the head, she tried to cover her head up and I hit her in the side of the head, like, and it went in. Oh my God. It went in her head and knocked a hole in it, unquote. Wow. What a detail to remember.
I'm sure he really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah.
Oh. Regarding the murder of Deborah Cook and why she was considerably younger than the other women who were murdered, Baco Bits explained during one of the police interviews that, according to him, Deborah was a crackhead, and a crackhead had testified against one of his brothers, Melvin Eugene Hobbs. That testimony had sent Hobbs to prison, and he, quote, wasn't going to let that happen again, unquote.
Wow. Okay, so Baco Bits said he had met Deborah at a local gas station and had immediately targeted her as his next murder victim. He claimed that he had offered her money for sex, but she wanted more than he was willing to pay. So he walked away. He claimed that she then followed him until he agreed to pay her what she wanted, which was $20. So this is an aside from Minnie, and shout out to Minnie for writing this episode and researching it.
Yeah. I forgot to say that. This episode is written by Minnie.
There we go. I feel like, she says, I feel like he made up the embellishment to the story just to try to further demean her. I think he decided to kill her. So he's the one who followed her or asked her to follow him so that he could get her to a place where he could assault and kill her without any witnesses. Not sure why I think that, but it just seems like he wanted to control the narrative after the fact, almost excuse himself for killing her by trying to make it seem like she deserved what she got. Like if she hadn't followed him, he wouldn't have killed her. She did not deserve what he did. I mean, even if the story is true and it had happened like that, like he said it did, she still didn't deserve it. But yeah, I think absolutely. It did. Yeah, she's right. I think it did not happen like he said. I think he's making excuses for himself. If you look at pictures of him, he's always got his superior look or smarmy smile on his face that makes me want to slap the shit out of him. And I think he gets his kicks out of demeaning women. Mm-hmm. And I think him saying those things about Deborah, who is no longer alive to tell her own story, was a way for him to try to further demean her. And I agree,
Minnie. She's on to something.
Bars, yeah. So now let's get into the trial. What do you got for us, Beth?
Baco Bits was charged with the murders of Sandra and Karen, the torture of Karen, and the assault and home invasion of Linda. His trial was scheduled for November 5th, 2007. During a hearing, a forensic expert for the state police, Jeffrey Nye, the science guy, testified that DNA left at the houses where Sandra and Karen were found either matched Baco Bits' DNA profile or didn't rule him out as a suspect.
During the trial, testimony showed Sandra had been stabbed 36 times. 36 times.
Wow.
By a knife from her own kitchen. Wow. One of the wounds went through a rib and severed artery. This is some serious rage here. And again, a very intimate way to kill someone. And you have to get really close to stab someone, and stab them that many times is overkill.
Yeah, he was in a rage.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Ooh, this feels icky.
Yeah, it does. Baco Bits, by then 28, was convicted by jury of two counts of first-degree premeditated murder, one count of assault with intent to murder, one count of torture, and one count of first-degree home invasion.
On June 18th, 2008, at the age of 28, frontal lobe fully formed, by the way, Baco Bits was sentenced to two terms of life imprisonment without parole for the murders of Sandra and Karen. He was also given concurrent 75 to 125 years in prison for each of the assaults on Sandra, Karen, and Linda, and for the torture of Karen, plus a term of 26 years and 8 months to 40 years in prison for the home invasion of Linda. So a lot of time, he's never getting out. But where are they now? Tell us, Beth.
Well, back in August 2007, after Baco Bits confessed to killing Carolyn Cronenberg, saying that he was glad that Claude, a man he'd never met before, was convicted of the crime.
Oh my God.
What a complete and absolute fucker.
A goddamn motherfucker. Oh my God.
Police and the Ingham County chief prosecutor decided to re-examine the evidence in the case against Claude McCollum, who had been convicted of killing Carolyn back in 2006.
I think this is a great move, but one that prosecutors' offices are reluctant to take. Maybe that's
very reluctant
now. Yeah. But I listen to wrongful convictions a lot. And even if there's overwhelming evidence, they still won't overturn
it. They don't like it.
Yeah. So they discovered that a previously unidentified fingerprint on a plastic bag found near the scene of the crime came from Baco Bits. An analysis of a damaged surveillance videotape showed Claude in a different campus building at the time that the murder of Carolyn, the professor, was committed.
Wow.
Yeah.
A state police detective had analyzed the surveillance tape before Claude's trial and had written a report in which he concluded that Claude could not have committed the crime. Could not have committed the crime.
Wow.
The trial prosecutors claimed that they had disclosed the report to Claude's defense attorney. Sure,
of
they
course,
did.
Yeah, right.
The defense attorney said that he did not see it. Of course, yeah, they did not.
They did not.
Oh, no. My God. That's horrible.
That's horrible. That's, I mean, that's a violation. That's, I think, yeah, that's called a Brady violation. You're supposed to give the other side, the prosecution is
all
supposed
the
to
evidence.
Give the defense.
Yeah.
All of it. Yeah. Wow. That is so awful. Don't vote for whoever that is, Lansing listeners, on your next election.
And not only that, but why would you want to convict somebody you know is not guilty? Why?
Because the numbers, you get more convictions,
yeah, no,
you get more support,
me.
You get,
yeah,
more money, more
no
funding.
Sense to me.
It's,
nope.
It's really diabolical. Yeah, it's
it is.
A,
it's
really
bullshit.
Awful
it's...
part of our system.
Ugh, gross.
And,
I hate it. I hate it here.
Right. And I don't think any consequences came of the prosecutor.
Yeah,
until
not that
I know. I think he got popped for, like, prostitution or engaging in he wasn't engaged in sex work, but he hired a sex worker, I think, allegedly. Don't fact check me on that,
okay,
but I think she might have
just made that up.
Yeah, so the detective had been questioned briefly about part of the video during the trial, but prosecutors did not ask him about his conclusion that Claude could not have committed this murder.
So let me get this straight. The prosecutors knew that Claude could not have committed the crime, yet were perfectly happy to work towards getting him convicted anyway. That is some, as we said, seriously fucked up bullshit.
Oh yeah, it's disgusting. And all Claude was doing was trying to answer their questions, and the system will chew you up and spit you and not let you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
In September 2007, the Ingham prosecuting attorney joined Claude's lawyer in asking the Michigan Court of Appeals to vacate his conviction. A little late, buddy, but I guess it's better late than never. So he was in prison for like, 2 years? Almost. The court granted the joint motion, and in October 2007, after almost 3 years spent in
three years,
waiting trial and then convicted and sent to prison, Claude was finally released, and the prosecuting attorney dismissed the charges.
In 2010, Claude settled a lawsuit against the county for $2 million. Amen.
Yeah. It should have been more.
Yeah. The lead prosecutor in McCollum's case was fired. Okay, at least he got fired.
Yeah.
After it was revealed that they didn't disclose the video evidence to the defense team that would have proven his innocence. Amen again.
Yes.
Although I think they should have added some prison time as well, just so that the prosecutor could directly experience what they'd done to this poor man.
Oh, I wish they had too. I mean, honestly, but there's a wonderful spot in hell for him with his name on it. That year, Bakobitz attempted to appeal his own convictions, claiming ineffective assistance of counsel, and he was denied. Denied. Bakobitz, who was by then serving multiple life sentences, was not charged with Carolyn's murder, as he was already in prison with no chance of getting out, and it was considered a waste of resources. Tell the family that.
He was also never charged with the murder of 45-year-old Barbara Jean Tuttle back in 2004, but considering that she was murdered in the same house and in the same manner and was about the same age as 46-year-old Deborah Renforce, it's highly likely he was responsible for her death as well.
Yep. Couldn't agree more. So now we're going to get into our takeaways and what we think made Macon snap. So this is from Minnie. And she says, I think the guy, as much as I hate who he grew up to be, had zero chance of really becoming anything else, given the childhood experiences that he had. Although I do wonder what became of his sister. Oh, yeah. Who went through the same abuse as a child and for longer. Did she turn out okay? If so, what were the differences in her life? I do also wonder why he picked the victims that he did. He clearly harbored rage toward older white women who lived alone. And I'm wondering who in his life was the person he was assaulting and killing in effigy over and over again. He did pick sex workers sometimes, but I wonder if that was because he thought they wouldn't be missed. Not sure. What do you think, Beth?
Well, I agree with Minnie. His childhood was atrocious.
Yeah.
And I think it made him a very angry man.
Mm-hmm.
And he took out his rage on women. Why he chose the ones he did, I don't know either. Mm-hmm. It's possible it was just the luck of the draw. It sounds like he went around knocking on women's doors to see who would let him in.
Yeah.
So, or, you know, maybe he targeted them. I don't really know. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
But definitely his childhood was mm-hmm. the biggest factor, I think.
Yeah. I think so, too. I'd also like to offer the most epic fuck you to the police, the detectives who preyed on Claude, a vulnerable yeah. adult, by the way. He had yeah. learning disabilities and he was experiencing homelessness. Yeah. I mean, how low can you get, officers
yeah.
and the prosecutors who tried him anyway?
Yeah.
I feel for the victims who lost their lives. But what was done to Claude was also horrifying.
Yeah.
And his life and freedom were taken because he just tried to do the right thing. And I feel bad for the child that was Matthew at one point, and I feel bad for his sister, the abuse they suffered. And it's interesting, his MO was what was done to him.
He, yes.
you know,
yeah.
in the, with using
That's
the foreign objects.
That's why it's obvious that it
meeting.
Was a, his yeah. childhood. Yeah.
Absolutely. Hurt people hurt other people. It's not an excuse, but certainly an explanation. And after he became a ward of the state, this is another thing that I think might have contributed, is he was like a thrown away. It's like the
yeah.
world was showing him and treating him like he was trash and disposable as a child.
Yeah.
And that's how he treated his victims. And the 36 stabbing thing and the severe beatings were overkill. I
yeah.
Luther said he beat one woman with the top of the lid of a toilet. You know, those
oh
heavy
my God.
Things.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And I think it speaks to how angry he was inside. However,
yeah.
he did say in his confession that he liked seeing the fear in people's faces, in their eyes.
Yeah.
And intentionally.
That's not surprising, really, because.
Given, yeah.
Yeah. Some people who are abused,
mm-hmm.
they relate to their abuser and they mm-hmm. become the abuser. And.
Mm-hmm.
They want to see that fear. It makes them feel powerful when they
yes.
felt powerless
right.
as a child.
Yeah. Right. And I think that he really got off on that.
Yeah.
My understanding is he intentionally targeted women who were alone because they would be defenseless against him.
Right.
So this is a really... I'd never heard of this individual. This case,
I hadn't either. Yeah.
It just the level of violence really blew me away.
Oh yeah, and how he kind of fucked with the police too.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, wow. Talk about brazen. So
yeah.
Now we are going to get into how not to get murdered. So if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of this segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's experiences.
So the past few episodes, I think we've asked listeners to come up with some tips.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't gotten many, but Lo Quinn, I think she maybe sensed we needed some laughs. So these are just a couple funny ones. Lo Quinn said, keep a friend around who's trained in Taekwondo. great tip. And
yeah.
One of her other tips, she gave a few. One was, be 6 feet tall and 300 pounds. Excellent tip. So, and it's the holidays, so I'm working on it. Also, it is still robbing season. So this
yeah.
one's from me. So keep your head on a swivel and don't open the door for anyone you don't know and you are not expecting.
Yeah.
So now it's shout out time, where we shout out any content by people of color or about people of color, any minoritized or otherwise groups of folks, or any true crime goodies. I got dose. Indefensible. Have you heard of it?
I think so.
Oh
yeah.
My God. It's like the Daily Show mixed with 2020 and Dateline.
Wow.
And it is so it's just really great. So it's with comedian, her name's Jenna Friedman, and she travels the country in this true crime series. And it's less of a whodunit and more of a why the fuck does this stuff keep happening? And in one part, she's talking to this lady who's talking about the economic strife that contributes to crime. So she's
okay.
So I see, if I give a man $50, then he won't beat the shit out of his wife. And she's the lady's not exactly. So she has conversations like that with people. And it's just really, it's a fresh take on, in true crime, and I like it.
Okay, cool.
Also, it's a show, so it's streaming.
Where is it streaming?
I don't remember. Hang on a second.
I just Googled it. It's AMC.
Okay, there you go. And then a podcast called Survivors Heal with Olia Sherrills. And she's a woman of color. She's a Black woman from the Bay Area. And I wonder if we knew each other like when we were kids. Anyway, by tackling the constructs that keep cycles of violence spinning and Survivors Heal, she interviews survivors of, there's only a few episodes out now, but like the first episode is her survivor story. She was raped numerous times and talks about all the experiences. So it might be hard to listen to
hard
if you
to
are a victim,
to, yeah.
But she always ends with a triumph. And so like she talked to just people who survived really hard things, violent crime, losing loved ones to violence, etc. So okay. It's wherever you get your podcast.
Oh, great recommendations.
Thank you. What do you got?
I wanted to shout out Welcome to Chippendales on Hulu. Oh,
I fucking love this show. I'm so glad you're shouting out.
So it's an 8-episode true crime docudrama starring Kumail Nanjiani. Is that how it's pronounced? Nanjiani?
Yes.
Yes.
Yummy. He's a yummy man.
Yeah, I know. I find him really attractive.
Yes. He's funny and handsome. Give me more.
And his voice. I love his voice.
Yeah, me too.
So it tells the true story behind Chippendales, the revolutionary all-male revue founded by Steve Banerjee in 1980s Los Angeles. It's a tale of male strippers, jealousy, and murder.
Yeah! I was like, what? Murder in Chippendales?
Yep.
This is wild! By the way, have you ever been to a Chippendales show?
I have not.
It's
no.
Pretty wacky in there.
So one time I was at a bar and they were, they had like a show before they opened up. It was like a dance club, right?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And I was waiting like in the bar area and there's like this other area where they were doing like an all male review.
Uh-huh.
And the women were just screaming.
They go nuts. It's
they
so
go wild.
I've never seen anything like it.
I know. And so I kind of like peeked behind the curtain where they all were to see what was going on and saw that it was an all-male review and that these women were just losing their minds. So it was wild. I don't really get it, but okay.
it is really funny. And they capture a lot of that in the show. Like,
yeah.
Kumail's character's like, what? People
what
like
is going
this?
On? Yeah.
So it's a really great show. I'm glad you shouted that out. Great shout out. So that is Indefensible with comedian Jenna Friedman on AMC, the podcast Survivors Heal with Olia L. Sherrills, and Welcome to Chippendales on Hulu.
What? Uh-oh. What? Uh-oh.
That's the end?
I found the end of the episode. It's here.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess that's it for today. Where can the people find us, Beth?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com, and we use Fruit Loops Pod for all of our social media. Join our discussion group on Facebook at Fruit Loops Pod Discussion. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App. Just Google Fruit Loops Pod Cash App, or you can become a monthly patron through Patreon. And as always, we have merch for sale on our website.
That's right. Now, this is a weekly podcast, and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, y'all. It's crazy out there.
True Terrors of Horror. bizarre happenings, unexplainable events. On our podcast, Disturbed, terror takes center stage. Each episode is a journey into the darkest corners of human existence, delving into bone-chilling tales of kidnappings, serial killers, maniacs, and the very essence of your worst nightmares coming to life on this weekly true horror show. Disturbed is not for the faint of heart. It's an exploration of real, unadulterated horror sourced from everyday people. Each episode is a descent into the macabre, where we narrate stories that will leave you on the edge of your seat and crawling in your skin. We navigate the disturbing narratives that lurk in the shadows, offering a raw and unfiltered listen into the most terrifying aspects of the human experience. Enter at your own risk and let the unsettling tales unfold in the haunting realm of Disturbed. And remember, listeners, stay safe out there.
Hello, this is Gary Chahot welcoming you to check out the French History Podcast. Our main show covers the history of France from the first humans until present. If you liked Mike Duncan's The History of Rome and wanted a similar program covering the land of beauty, culture, and love, we are exactly that. We also host world-renowned scholars who have delivered guest episodes on their specialties, including 18th century pirates, revolutionary booksellers in 20th century Paris, the special friendship between the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson, and numerous others. Learn what you love and listen to the French History Podcast today.